You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jeff Perkins. Jeff, thanks so much for being with me today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to participate.
Jeff, you've had a really fascinating history, and I know some of the work you're doing now comes out of that. So maybe we should just jump right into one moment that I know was kind of pivotal in your career, if I can say that, which was meeting Tony Cox and Yoko Ono. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Which was, I think, in late 63 in Tokyo. I was in the military. I was stationed in Tachikawa, Japan, which is about 40 minutes outside of Tokyo. And before I went into the Air Force, I was an art student in New York. And I was really just about a year and a half into being a young art student. And so I was also reading a lot in high school. And I graduated from high school in 59. And during high school, I pretty much educated myself by reading popular books at the time, the Beat Generation books, and existential philosophy books, and some historic literature as well. My father was a great reader, and he influenced me to read as well. So I came to Tokyo because I had an option to choose my service base. And so I did. I chose Tokyo because I had read quite a bit about Zen, and I was thinking, well, I'm going to find Zen in Japan. And when I got there, I went right away into Tokyo, and I explored Tokyo, and I found myself frequenting these little jazz bars and also coffee shops in Shinjuku. And about 6 months into the Tokyo experience, I was in a bar and I was talking with an American journalist. I told her that I was interested in finding some LSD, which I had actually taken before in New York in about 1960, 61. Mm-hmm. I went into the Air Force in 62. So she said that she knew of an American guy who was married to a famous Japanese dancer. And she gave me his phone number. So I called that number, and the guy came on the line, and I told him who I was, and I had been in New York, and he was, "Oh, great, you're from New York. You know, we're from New York, too. Why don't you come out and visit us?" So he gave me instructions, and by train that night, I went out and found, in this very beautiful neighborhood, in fact, at night, this gated street. And I rang the bell, and a guy answered the gate, and I went to the living room, and we sat down in front of a fireplace. It was a Western-style house, and quite a big house, in fact, for Tokyo. And so we were talking and all that, and there was a staircase leading up to this, I guess, the second-floor bedroom. And pretty soon a woman came walking down the staircase wearing a muumuu, a black muumuu, I believe. And I could see that she was pregnant, quite a bit pregnant, in fact. So she walked past us and behind us and went into the kitchen and was in there for a while and then went back out and back upstairs. Well, that was Tony Cox and Yoko Ono. And I think I bought.
And again, you went there because you're looking for
for acid. You're there to buy some tabs, right?
Yeah, psychedelic something. So Tony had this little vial of liquid that he gave me, and I bought it from him. I forget what it was. Didn't matter what it would cost. So that was the end of the meeting. So the next thing was that I guess recontacted them, and Tony invited me over to visit them again. And this time there was a different address, and the place they were living was a very kind of small, very small apartment. And I remember going, it was a Japanese-style, you know, common folk apartment. And I went into the place, and pretty soon Yoko came walking out of the bedroom carrying a child. So that child was Kyoko Ono. And so that was the beginning of a future friendship of ours. And eventually... they moved to a much larger apartment in Shibuya, and I would I really didn't have any other friends in the military, so these were my new friends, and I knew right away that these were very elegant and hip people, and I was just thrilled to meet them, and especially Yoko, who was particularly beat and eccentric. And long black hair, and wow, she was like this ultimate Japanese beatnik. And so I was always eager to go visit them in their apartment, and which I did. so we had a very active and measured friendship during the 2 years that I was stationed in Tokyo, and that eventually continued to, actually I was stationed next in Washington, D.C., and I think they came down to Washington once to visit and to meet another friend, a new artist friend named Royce Dendler, who was a sculptor. And after that, I got discharged in 66 in January, and I moved to New York, and they rented me a small room in their apartment at 1 West 100th Street. Now, many things happened in Tokyo after I met them, and I felt like that I was, you know, an American friend of theirs and a New Yorker, and they were very happy to know me. And I was about 10 years younger than them, and so they saw me as a student, I presume. And basically, Yoko was feeding me many documents and kind of recommending things for me in Tokyo. For example, she recommended that I go to see the No Theater, and she said, don't go to the Kabuki, that's for the common folk. Go to see the No, that's real Zen, which I did. A couple of times I went to the No Theater in Tokyo. She also recommended that I read John Cage's book, Silence. And I bought, that was John Cage's first book. And so I bought that book. Also, she recommended that I read the book, The I Ching Book of Changes. And I bought my first copy of The I Ching Book of Changes in the Kanda, the book section of Tokyo at the time. And at that time, I was working in a psychiatric hospital in for the U.S. Air Force in Tachikawa. And I got to do the night shift, which I liked very much because I could read all night. And I did a great deal of reading. Yoko, having passed on many things, she gave me a copy of an anthology and also a copy of Wolf Vostell's Décollage, and those two books, and Silence and The I Ching Book of Changes, were my study at the time, and I did a great deal of study of them. I got very interested in The I Ching and made, I did some writings about The I Ching, and also the writings and things, compositions, etc., in an anthology, were extremely influential to me, because I had never seen anything quite like that before. So meeting Yoko and Tony was my introduction to the avant-garde, and I was ready for that. I was a prime candidate, and I was what age was I? I was 23, something like that. Yeah, and you know, Yoko was very well connected with the avant-garde scene in Tokyo at the time, and because of that, I got to join them in various events and performances and exhibitions. In particular, the exhibition at the NIQUA Gallery, N-I-Q-U-A Gallery, in Shinbashi, was a particularly influential in exhibition by a group called the High Red Center. And I will return to this later. The High Red Center group was the primo avant-garde trio at the time in Tokyo. It also happened that when I went to the opening of at High Red Center at the NIQUA, it was a particularly strange event because I went there with two other American friends who were civilians, and we arrived and the door of the gallery was boarded shut and with signs on it saying show canceled. So we were puzzled, and I said, let's go have something to eat, and we did. And after having something to eat, I said, well, let's go back and check again. So we went back, and the door was open, and the room was full of people drinking beer. And that was a particular exhibition by High Red Center. And in the center of the room was a chair, and sitting in the chair was a painter named Sam Francis, and standing next to him was the painter Jasper Johns. And somehow I knew who that was. You see, I was aware of abstract art at that time because I was very interested in it as a student, you see. So this was a very thrilling happenstance for me. After the opening, we went to a bar, a basement bar, and in the bar in the next booth to us was sitting Sam Francis with a famous critic. I think his name is Tono. Yoshioki Tono. In any case. So that was, you know, phenomenal. All of this was like,
wow.
Spectacular for me as a kid, you know. I was getting a good dose of the hippest thing going at the time, you know, reading all of George's stuff. And I mean, George was just had begun Fluxus at that time, as a matter of fact, so I had a very early bite at Fluxus. Yoko also decided to stage an important performance at a place called Sogetsu Kaikan. Sogetsu Kaikan was at that time also a flower arrangement school that also had a experimental music lab, a tape music lab. I think it was before electronic music. These composers, Ichinagi and maybe Tono and maybe Kosugi, and these young avant-garde composers were working with tape music and also, you know, writing compositions. So that's what Sogetsu was cultivating. And also, Sogetsu had a very large and beautiful performance auditorium. And in fact, the painter Sam Francis had been commissioned to paint a mural on site there at Sogetsu. And I saw that mural. I think that he painted it in 64. So it was pretty fresh in the downstairs lobby of the auditorium. So with Yoko's performance, which was called Farewell to Tokyo Concert by Yoko Ono, I was invited to perform in this concert. And I mean, I had no idea about that, you see. And so they, Tony and Yoko, took this as my kind of, what it was, my baptism, so to speak, into a performance in avant-garde art, you see. So I did perform with Tony Cox a piece that I think was partly his composition or structure, along with an announcement that Yoko made in the auditorium. The piece was basically, the lights in the auditorium were completely turned out, and Tony and I were tied by Yoko back to back very tightly with ropes, so that we were pressed, our bodies were pressed tightly up against each other's backs, and there were bottles hanging off the edge of the ropes and thing. And the instruction was that we were to walk across the stage from one side to the other and then back again without making a sound, which was very difficult because we had these sound makers hanging off of ropes that we were tied to. And while we were doing that, Yoko Ono announced to the audience that the audience could light one match to see if they could see on the floor of the auditorium two snakes that she had liberated into the audience. So that was the performance, and that was the first performance that I ever did in my life. So after that, I mean, there were
so you knew met, you said you were meeting, you had met George Mascherinis at this time as well?
No, George never went to Tokyo, unfortunately.
Okay.
I know he wanted to because he really cultivated the Tokyo connection for Fluxus, and he brought several of those artists to New York, Miyako Shiomi, Shigeko Kubota, and Nam June Paik eventually came as well. I was also invited to participate in the Fluxus Festival at the University of Hawaii, the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii, by a composer scholar that I met through Yoko in Tokyo named Frederick Lieberman. And so Fred staged, I believe, the first Fluxus, it might have been the first Fluxus Festival, in fact, at the East-West Center. And this was quite a big deal. And they also, at the time, there was a new auditorium that was recently renamed, the John F. Kennedy Auditorium, and it was huge. It was a very big auditorium with a big balcony and projectors and everything like that. And there was to be contemporary classical music performed there. And the two composers that were invited were John Cage and Toru Takemitsu. And I had met Takemitsu, in fact, in Tokyo, when he gave me one of his beautiful compositions. And so I was able to assist John Cage in his piece, which is a prepared piano piece, along with playing music from turntables in the control booth, which is what I was doing. So there was another part of that, which was really a performance of Fluxus pieces and John Cage pieces at the Music School of the University of Hawaii East West Center. So I was there for 2 weeks, and I got in a little bit of trouble because I was on a pass, you know. I had a week pass from my job, and I decided to stay another week. So I just stayed. So my commander, I don't know, gave me a little penalty. It was nothing really. So this was another thing, you see. So maybe you can jump in any time, by the way. But my next move, of course, was to move in to the apartment with Tony and Yoko. And at the time, they were both on macrobiotic diet. And so we were eating together and living there in that apartment together with Kyoko, the baby, and several several things happened, and several Fluxus things happened. And in fact, George Matunas, I had not met Matunas. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Yoko and Tony brought me down to Soho to George Matunas' West Broadway apartment. And he received us. And George was very interested in Yoko Ono for a long time. He had given Yoko her first exhibition at his AG gallery on Madison Avenue in New York in 61, I think it was. And so he basically was living in a small railroad apartment, and one walked into the door opened, you're in the kitchen, and to the left there was a small room, which was George's room, and it had a tatami floor, a Japanese straw tatami floor, and the walls were made of cabinets, and George had made these cabinets. Apparently he was kind of a skilled cabinet maker. So he was showing us works that were in these very small boxes that were in the cabinets. And I remember one in particular was a chess set that was made by Smell, that was played by Smell. It was Smell chess, okay? So that was my first meeting with George. And after that, George decided to make a Fluxus Film Festival. And at the time, I had a Bolex camera, which I had bought in Tokyo, in fact.
And, that's a 16-millimeter camera, right?
Exactly, yeah, 100-roll camera. And so Yoko invited me to make a film, and she decided that she would make a film. And that film was called Fluxus Film Number 4, which later came to be called The Bottoms Movie. And that film was made in the living room of our apartment there at 1 West 100th Street. And basically it was that friends were invited to come and take their pants off and walk bare-assed in front of the camera while I sat on a hand truck holding the camera, and Tony pushed me along to follow behind them while I held the frame. I mean, it was, I held the same frame as we followed the naked ass walking. So that was Yoko's Bottoms movie. And she also suggested that I make a film. So I decided to make a film called Shout, which was basically a picture, a 2-minute film of Tony Cox and I in profile having an argument, shouting at each other. And it was a quick idea that I got because Tony and Yoko's bedroom was next to mine, and they were arguing all the time. So I decided that I would restage their argument, and I would play Yoko, and Tony would be Tony. So we had the argument, but of course there was no sound. It wasn't a sound camera. So it was a silent argument, you see. So that was in the first Fluxus Film Festival at the Cinematheque 16 or something, Jonas Mekas' theater on West 41st Street. So after that, George decided to do a piece at the Village Gate Restaurant, which is this very big, high-ceiling restaurant. And the event was called Timothy Leary's Birthday Party, but I don't think Timothy Leary had anything to do with it. He wasn't there. He wasn't performing anything. But the Velvet Underground did perform on stage with Nico, Gerard Malanga, you know, dancing, etc. And the piece that George did basically was to create a very complex spider web above, high above the heads of the audience, which was seated at tables. So we had three ladders, I think, well, two that I know of, and we had to climb up these ladders and bring strings across the whole room in these different directions to make the spider web. And then George had us bring sticky tape laying on top of the string, which he had anchored all of this to one spot, which he cut at a certain point, and all of it fell on the audience, sticking everybody together. his idea of that. Also, Yoko also asked me to perform a piece of hers, which was a painting, which is a piece called Painting to Shake Hands. And this was simply a large canvas with a hole in it, which I would stick my hand out through. And I did that sitting there at the stage with the Velvets as they played, you see. And Andy was there. I remember asking Andy a question. I don't know when I asked him something. And he was a cool outer. I don't know. But anyway.
And Andy Warhol, you mean. Andy Warhol was there because of the Velvet Underground and that whole scene.
Yeah, it was basically a Velvet Underground concert with George doing his crazy sticky web. Also, during this time, Tony conceived of a piece called The Stone. And this piece was an installation at the Judson Church Gallery at Washington Square. And they invited me to be a part of that installation, which was basically, I made a film, which is a text film. It was just words. And the piece was a very beautiful piece. It was, I mean, the whole installation, I mean. And it was basically a paper room that was supported by wooden structure with paper walls that the visitors to the show were asked to get into a black bag that you could not see into, but you could see out of. You could see, you know, if you're in the bag, you could see what was going on outside, but people looking at you from inside couldn't see you. Tony had a little map on the floor, and there was another artist, Michael Mason, who created a sound loop for it. And he also made a pair of very weird glasses that were not part of the installation, but they were in, you know, outside of the stone shape. And those glasses were strobing glasses. You put them on and they were strobing, and they were glasses to get you high, you see. And there was also a catalog for the show, and I have not seen that catalog. I have a copy of it, but I have never seen it any other place. The show was reviewed in the Village Voice and the New York Examiner, and there was a big spread, a good spread, a picture of Tony and Yoko and I in that. And Tony and Yoko thought it was a great piece, and they wanted to move it to Off-Broadway. They were very ambitious and all that. But anyway, they were friends with owner of a Zen macrobiotic restaurant in East 6th Street called the Paradox Restaurant. And so the owner agreed to move the stone into the Paradox Restaurant, where Yoko was also working part-time as a waitress. They also at that time found a beautiful loft building on 2nd Avenue at 6th Street, 99 2nd Avenue, where we all also lived together at that place. And so the stone went on there, and that was pretty great and fun.
And at this time, this is still like we're in the early 60s here, 64. Had you met, I mean, obviously this is a kind of Fluxus influence, and in the context of Fluxus, was it around that time you met George? I know a lot of things happened, and you met Nam June Paik, and I want to talk about George. But
I didn't meet Nam June in New York then. I didn't meet Nam June until later in California at CalArts when he was teaching. However, I was present at a piece that Nam June installed or staged at Yoko's apartment in Shibuya. And this is an extraordinary piece, basically. The apartment was a one-room tatami floor room with a little kitchen and a bathroom. And Nam June announced the show that he was going to exhibit two very rare Zen books. And what these books were they were huge books. They were like 4 feet by 3 feet and by 1 foot thick. They were in leather-bound books, very beautiful books. And on the pages of these books were blank. There was nothing on the pages. And so Nam June just put the books in the room, sat them there. There were two of them. It was a two-volume book. And people were invited.
Both volumes were all blank pages.
All blank pages. And so I was invited to come one day, and I did. And it turned out that Shigeko Kubota, Nam June's future wife, came in, and she was able to go into the room and visit the books while we sat in the kitchen, Tony and Yoko and I, and Kyoko. Actually, I don't know if Kyoko. Well, yeah, anyway. So we were sitting there for quite a while, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting, and nothing was going on. So we opened the shoji screen to look, and Shigeko had opened both books on the floor, opened them wide, and was sleeping on the books. And she, of course, ended up sleeping with Nam June in New York, marrying him, you know. So that was kind of a providential piece, I'd say. That was very... Nam June was Nam June was a great star. Actually, I was at an exhibition of Yoko's at the Nikkei Gallery, a piece called Fly, where Yoko staged this piece called Fly. And she invited a number of people, one of which was I, to come to be a part of this piece, Fly. So I went, and Yoko announced that basically she would like us to either talk about how we fly or to demonstrate how we fly, you know, any way that we liked. Also, she said, every once in a while, we're going to hear the phone ring, and I'm just going to let it ring, and that's going to be Nam June Paik calling, and he'll be attending by telephone, and because he had something else to do or something like that. So I had still not met Nam June. So anyway, pretty soon Yoko and Tony got very interested in what was going on in London, and they decided to go to London to participate in an auto-destructive art festival by a guy who actually, I think, is still alive and lives in Brooklyn, and I forget his name just now. So they decided to, go to London, and I was left with the three-floor apartment at 99 Second Avenue while they went on to London to, Yoko was at this time very ambitious. And she was always, a star, you see, prima donna. Tony used to be on her about that. You want to be the Elizabeth Taylor of art and all that kind of thing. And she was. I mean, Yoko was an aristocrat in Japan, and she carried that with her wherever she went and whatever she did. And all of her work was basically towards that, I mean, to be a star. Also, I happened to, in 65, while I was stationed in Washington, they invited me to come to New York because Yoko was going to do a premiere performance at the Carnegie Recital Hall, and that piece was called Cut Piece. And she invited,
sure, yeah, very well known. Yeah, when,
yeah,
where
so
she,
I was
yeah.
there. I was backstage for that piece, and that was quite a rare thing. She had performed
Yeah, I mean, in the context of what you're saying also about, you know, aristocratic or ambitious, Carnegie Hall, of course, isn't a typical place for any Fluxus.
Carnegie Recital Hall,
which I guess you could rent at that time, right? I don't know.
Yes, a much smaller room. Yeah. Right. Yeah, Norman Seaman had Norman Seaman was a producer, and he arranged all that for Yoko. You know, and they had. She'd also done another piece at Carnegie Recital. It was called Grapefruit in the World of Park. And that was a performance festival kind of that Lamont was a part of, and Tara Jennings, and, well, a number of other people, Jackson McClough maybe. That was before I met her. That was in 61, I think. The Carnegie Recital Hall was the kind of avant-garde performance hall at that time. The uptown one, anyway, you see. Yeah.
And so then you're in New York, and where does I wanted to tell you to tell the story of how you started the film on George Matunis, which you're currently still working on, which must have began around this time. Right?
No. I was not really a filmmaker. I consider myself to be an artist, and the camera was an art tool for me. I did not have any idea of myself as a filmmaker, although I had made the Fluxus film and shot the Bottoms movie as well. But a movie? No, that was not in my sensibility. I had seen Warhol film. I had seen maybe Brackage. I had seen a couple of underground films, and so I knew. I remember seeing Vinyl in New York in. That was some, but it was all about art film. So after Tony and Yoko moved to London, I moved to Los Angeles. And in fact, I did many different kinds of things in Los Angeles. One of them was I was a manager of an experimental movie theater on Sunset Strip called the Cinematheque 16. And we were showing premiere or experimental or underground films, and I was booking that theater.
And that was with Jonas. That's Jonas Mekas.
Mekas wasn't involved with that at all. No, this theater was owned by a man who wanted to show movies. Although, of course, we were getting films from the Filmmakers Co-op in New York, which is Jonas Mekas's. Jonas started the Filmmakers Co-op. There was also another source in San Francisco. There were lots of underground filmmakers in San Francisco at the time as well. So that's where we were getting films. And during that time, I was asked to start a light show, because we were doing multimedia movie events at the theater as well. This theater was right in the center of Sunset Strip at the time, near the Whiskey A Go-Go, and this was 1967, 68, 69, and the Sunset Strip was a boiling pot of freaks and culture and all kinds of stuff. What did Dick Higgins call it? Intermedia. So the light show got started for I also did some Fluxus performances when I first got there, because Fred Lieberman was moved from Hawaii to UCLA, where he got his PhD, I think. And Fred and Joe Bird produced a couple of concerts in which I did Fluxus-esque performances. In fact, I performed Yoko's Bag piece, which was a big hit, but because I performed it with my voluptuous girlfriends. We got into this bag on the stage of the student union, and she was a dish, and so people were shouting about it. And so we got into the bag and just basically we broke up in the bag. But that was Bobby Shaw, and so I was, you know, I was expanding. I was beginning to be a filmmaker. And also during that time, I came into meeting Sam Francis, who was living there then. And Sam Francis became the primary patron of the light show, the single wing turquoise bird light show, which I named. And I like to think of it because Kosugi also did a psychedelic music group in Tokyo, the Taj Mahal Travelers. Eventually I came to start filming Sam Francis at work as a matter of consequence of our meeting frequently because of his patronage of our light show. And it was then that I started to shoot movies, okay? Now, the idea of George, the film George, I had finished the Sam Francis film in 2008. It took 40 years, basically, to make that film on Sam Francis, and it is a good film. I am proud to say that I made that film, thepaintersamfrancis.com, thank you very much. And so after finishing that film, I was walking with my friend Kristen Zatrick, the director of the Emily Harvey Foundation Gallery, on Houston Street, and I thought, George's name came into my head. I just thought, George, and I said, wait a minute, nobody's made a film about George, and I just learned how to make a film by making Sam Francis. So I felt I was ready, and I needed a job, in fact. So I just, at that point, I immediately contacted the two heirs to George Matthews's estate, and they were very happy to sign permissions for me to make this film on George Matthews, which we're just about to finish. And wow. I can't tell you the details of the finishing, but it is going to be opening in New York in February.
That's exciting. That's great to hear. So in February, it'll be opening in New York. And when that happens, I'll also tell everyone that's listening that that's happening. And perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about it at that time or just afterwards. It's great talking to you.
Okay, good. We've used up on it all the time.
Well, that's okay. No. You can keep talking. I was going to ask you also what you're reading at the moment, because we can't talk too much more about that film, as you're saying, but it's exciting that it's being done, exciting that it's going to be shown in February, which perhaps we can discuss more at a later date after it's out. I'd love to talk again. So what is it that you're reading now? The question
I'm looking at a great book, which is, the title of the book is The Principles of Art by Akasegawa Genpei, G-E-N-P-E-I, from the 1960s to the present. Now, Akasegawa Genpei was the prime artist of High Red Center. And this book was given to me as a gift when I was in Tokyo a couple of years ago by a gallerist. And it is an amazing book. It's in Japanese, in fact. So, well, there's some English titles of the works. And Genpei is known in Japan, but he is not known very well in America. And he is like an extraordinarily, you know, gifted and talented and great artist. And unfortunately, he passed away, I think, about a year and a half ago. So,
Well, thanks for that. And, you know, the one question that I didn't ask that still stays in my mind, and perhaps we will talk again after all this, because it's really been exciting hearing about all of this, is what happened to that vial of acid that you got from Tony?
I was paranoid about it. It looked brownish and weird, and I was paranoid. I didn't ever take it, you know. And I don't know whatever happened to it. You know, when I took LSD in New York in like 1960, And they were like sugar cubes, you know, and like I wasn't like addicted to LSD or anything, but that's how I first found it. It was given to me in a bar. A guy said, "Would you like to get high?" And I said, "Well, yes, I had smoked pot since I was in high school." And so he said, "Here, well, this is going to make you really high." And I said, "Okay." So I took it, and with a friend, Tony Watkins, a painter, was going to this, he was in a painting school. We both took it on this very snowy night, and wow, that was wonderful. It was a great experience.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and
good.
And I wish you the best on the film in February. That's so exciting.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.